Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. When we look up at the night sky with its tiny dots of distant lights, most of us feel a sense of awe of just being one particle in a gigantic universe. The night sky also inspires a sense of longing to explore what's out there and to learn more about the most distant planets and galaxies.
Okay, all flight controllers, gonna go for landing. Retro, go,
On today's show, we'll look into the latest advancements in space travel and discuss some of the challenges that have so far kept us from building a community on Mars or elsewhere in space. Also, how a classic sci-fi movie got the future totally wrong, and a historic moment where Houston had to squash mutiny in space. A lot of us are excited about the possibility of humans living on distant planets, but some think it's crucial to the survival of our species. Like SpaceX founder and futurist Elon Musk, he predicts that there'll be some kind of doomsday event on Earth, so that means we have to find other places to live. But if you want to send people and all of their stuff beyond our solar system, then you have to solve what seems perhaps like a mundane problem: fuel. Alan Yu is here now to talk more. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Maiken. So the problem is that if right now we use rockets to get to space, but that means carrying a lot of fuel with you. And if you want to go further in the solar system, that means you have to stop to refuel. Otherwise, you'll be carrying a lot of extra weight. Now, you could use nuclear fuel, and that's what the New Horizons probe that got to Pluto used. But then you won't have a lot of power left over on your spaceship. Now, Star Wars got around this problem by creating a hyperdrive.
Both trap yourselves in. I'm going to make a jump to light speed.
But light speed is not possible, right?
No, we can't do that right now. So on the slightly more plausible side, Star Trek created warp drives.
Maximum warp. Punch it.
Whoa, that sounded like a lot of explosions. How does a warp drive work?
Right, so basically that requires using antimatter to make a giant explosion, and we can't make enough antimatter right now for that kind of a boom. Now, the sci-fi show The Expanse has a relatively practical solution. A recent episode had a character called Solomon Epstein explaining how his nuclear fusion drive changed everything for mankind.
Because with my drive, the Epstein drive, Mars would be able to move outward, mine the asteroids, colonize the belt, and remake the solar system. My drive would give us the edge we needed to finally break free from Earth and build a new world for ourselves.
So you need some dramatic music and also a fusion drive. How does fusion power work again?
Right, so what we have in nuclear power plants right now is nuclear fission, and that's when you split atoms to release energy. Nuclear fusion is what powers the sun. You stick charged particles together, and that releases a lot of energy. Now, that is something scientists actually are working on. I went to the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab in New Jersey to see this in action.
So you need your IDs, whatever you brought.
They have a nuclear fusion drive. Well, a very, very early version of one called the direct fusion drive. Stephanie Thomas is an aerospace engineer at the private company Princeton Satellite Systems. She's working on a spaceship that would use this drive to get to Pluto. And that's a partnership between her company and the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab. She started on that proposal in 2015.
And New Horizons had just reached Pluto, and it flew by Pluto. You know, it said hi Pluto, bye Pluto, at 14 kilometers per second, and it has the power of about two light bulbs on board, and each picture takes 2 days.
So again, that's very little power left inside New Horizons. NASA recently awarded Stephanie's fusion project close to $1 million because it could be a lot more productive than the fuel they used for the New Horizons mission to Pluto.
It's like HDTV data rates back or better, you know, because we have so much power available. And the reason all these communications is limited is because of power. So, you know, if we can put, you know, 100 kilowatts into our laser beaming back our data, we can just produce huge amounts of data. And now your science mission is just returning so much more information.
Right now, the fusion drive her team is building isn't much to look at, and it's hard to even know what to focus on. There's a clear cylinder in the middle, about as long as a desk, with a glowing purple light, multiple bundles of wires dangling from the ceiling, and a large chunk of pink foam. The drive works in three steps. Pass electricity through a gas, which creates plasma, a charged gas. Heat the plasma with radio waves, which works a bit like a microwave oven. Pump in another gas, that gas gets really hot and shoots out the end, so it's like you have a jet engine. I'm not saying you should do this, but if you take that thing outside the room and point it somewhere, would it shoot up?
Yes, if we took it in outer space, yes, definitely there's some thrust.
But physicist Samuel Cohen also says right now it's nothing compared to the rockets we use to send Apollo astronauts to the moon.
Liftoff. We have liftoff.
Those are called Saturn rockets.
The Saturn rocket, though, uses up all its propellant in about 8 minutes. Our rocket would continue to provide thrust for a year, 2 years, 10 years, and so eventually we get up to speeds much greater than the Saturn can get up to.
And it's not just about space. This fusion drive could be a clean power source on Earth. It produces far less radioactive material compared to existing reactors and other ideas for nuclear fusion. Michael Paluszek of Princeton Satellite Systems explains.
To a power company, it's really the ideal power source. You bring it in, it's fully fueled, you run it for 30 years, and if you need 10 more megawatts, you just order another one, it's delivered by truck, and there you go.
The machine they have now is made mostly of old equipment, some of which is 30 years old, which means it was cheap. Now they're working on a newer version to get closer to producing fusion power, while solving some technical problems. They had one the day I went there. Here's Sam Cohen, the physicist.
We think a $3 object is broken inside a cabinet, so we're trying to find a replacement for this $3 object.
The company that makes this $3 object went out of business, but they fixed the problem the next day. All of this may sound like Back to the Future meets MacGyver, but there's a NASA program that specifically pays for ideas that may seem kind of crazy.
NIAC is all about what do we think about that is science fiction right now that could be possible in the future.
That's Jason Derleff, and he's one of the people at NASA in charge of NIAC, the NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts Program. NIAC spends a little bit of money, very little compared to NASA's budget, and pays for ideas that are too far out for the National Science Foundation or other branches of NASA. In fact, NIAC has an external advisory group that doesn't work for NASA to make sure they are not spending money on things that are too easy.
NIAC is so far out and crazy, and NASA's culture is very risk averse. And so when we started the program up again in 2010, it was thought that having an external counsel would be a good idea because NASA will naturally sort of go towards what's feasible. We didn't want the culture of NASA to slowly change the program over time.
The council also makes sure NIAC doesn't pay for something that is pure science fiction and won't work out. A recent NIAC project that you may have heard of involves using a giant laser to push a tiny spaceship that weighs less than a paperclip so it can go outside our solar system. One of the people on that project is Philip Lubin, a physicist at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
You know, the NIAC program is one of those programs which is like a fuse. You know, they allow you to light a fuse and they provide the match. And in our case, you know, this thing is really sort of mushroomed, and it's grown dramatically based on the NIAC program starting to fund us.
Since the NIAC grant, Russian billionaire philanthropist Yuri Milner set up a $100 million program to build the laser-powered spaceships. The project is now called Breakthrough Starshot. Philip Lubin says his team is working on a prototype laser, but it'll probably take 30 years for the technology to advance and the cost to go down. So the NIAC projects will take some time to develop, but Ariel Wallman, one of the people on the NIAC External Council, says it's a good time to be watching them.
Well, science fiction continues to inform and be provocative towards what can really come in the future of space exploration. I think we're also at a point where science is being provocative in terms of where science fiction should go. And I think that's an exciting time to really be alive.
For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
We're talking about space on the show today, and Alan was just speaking with Ariel Waldman, and she said it's an exciting time to be alive. And I'm sure people felt that way in the 1960s when the US and Russia were spending billions on a race to the moon, and it seemed like the start of a grand spacefaring era that would soon bring us to Mars or beyond. But that is not how things panned out. Wade Rausch explores why not.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Long before NASA sent real astronauts to the moon in 1969, we'd already been there in our imaginations. And the most vivid depiction of what it might be like to live on the moon or travel to other planets came in the famous film 2001, A Space Odyssey. The movie showed a whole city on the moon and a giant rotating space station. And there were astronauts traveling to Jupiter in search of aliens. One of the main characters was a thinking computer named Hal.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
The movie, which hit theaters in 1968, was directed by Stanley Kubrick. He wrote the 2001 screenplay with futurist Arthur C. Clarke. He was the guy who came up with the idea for the communication satellites that now relay phone calls and TV signals around the globe. The screenwriters studied the Apollo space program, and from there, they used their imaginations, creating one of the most detailed visions of the future ever put down on film. But when you look at the world of the movie, and you compare it to the world we actually got by the year 2001, it's clear that reality came up short. In the movie, for instance, passengers flew into space on rocket planes owned by Pan American Airlines.
Pan Am will bring you the plane with all the room in the world.
Not only were those space planes never built, the real Pan Am went out of business in 1991. And why didn't we get talking computers like Hal? I mean, these days we do have Siri and Alexa and Cortana.
The average temperature of Mars is about minus 53 degrees Fahrenheit.
But unlike Hal, they aren't very good at conversation.
Sorry, I don't know that.
And we still don't have the first clue about how to make a computer conscious. Screenwriters Kubrick and Clarke put a lot of research and rigor into their predictions. But today, the movie seems naive and overly optimistic. There are lots of theories about how the movie got the future so wrong. The best one is what I call the carousel of progress is stuck. That's a name I came up with after visiting Disney World. Things didn't quite go right at a show called The Carousel of Progress. Everyone in the audience sat down in a ring of seats, and then the whole ring rotated around the central stage. There were robot people chattering about the benefits of electric lights in the 1900s, refrigerators in the 1920s, and television in the 1940s. And between acts, they sang this goofy song. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow. So there was this 1940s robot dad talking about the family's rumpus room. But then the whole show broke down. From where I was sitting, I got stuck listening to the robot dad doing his lines over and over. Eventually, a Disney mechanic came and fixed the carousel, and the audience finally moved on to the present. There's a book that argues that technological progress in America really did get stuck, kind of like that carousel. The book is called The Rise and Fall of American Growth, and it says the year when progress stopped was 1970. That theory is from economist Robert Gordon, and his big idea is that there was a wave of technological advances after the Civil War that was so rapid and so deep that nothing since then has measured up.
Gordon's theory is that the big advances from the late 19th century, the 1970s, were truly huge things. Refrigeration, antisepsis, highways, airplanes.
This is Jason Ponton. He's the former editor-in-chief of MIT Technology Review. And he boils down the book like this. You may feel like you just couldn't live without digital conveniences like Snapchat or Instagram, but getting an iPhone in your pocket just doesn't change your life in the same way as getting electricity in your house or a car in your driveway.
He thinks that the internet and personal computers are relatively small things compared to the big stuff.
So, back to the movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
I am putting myself to the fullest possible use, which is all I think that any conscious entity can ever hope to do.
If the carousel of progress really is stuck, that might explain why the movie's grand vision turned out to be a mirage. The screenwriters, Kubrick and Clark, had high expectations, and maybe the reason was that they came of age in an era when massive progress seemed normal. For one thing, they got to see the first people fly to space. So maybe it wasn't outrageous to think that by the year 2001, we might have moon bases or giant space stations or even thinking computers. But just because we don't have those things yet doesn't mean we'll never get them. Ponton says we have the tools to make fundamental progress. Consider the new wave of innovations in artificial intelligence and gene editing. What we may have lost, though, is our faith in ourselves.
There also needs to be a new feeling about our common humanity, that we want to go and solve these problems. We have to want the future.
In the end, what makes 2001 a great movie is that it did believe that we can extend our collective grasp. The movie wasn't really about space stations or talking computers or aliens. It was about us, growing up as a species, to the point where we leave the Earth, reach other planets, and even give consciousness to our machines.
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before.
If we can recapture this kind of optimism, we might still make these big things happen, just not quite so soon.
That's Wade Rausch, and you can hear a longer version of this story on his podcast. It's called Soonish. Astronauts have to be really healthy in order to qualify to go on a mission, but still, things can go wrong. Space missions have a crew medical officer, not a real doctor, but an astronaut who's had about 30 hours of medical training. I spoke with physician Julie Lin Wong. She's an expert in aerospace medicine, and she told me that during that brief training, astronauts have to learn all sorts of procedures. And some get a lot more complicated in space. For example, CPR.
The way we normally perform CPR here on Earth is you sort of straddle the patient and you perform chest compressions. That is quite a bit of a challenge on board the International Space Station because you're in free fall. And so typically they'll actually do a handstand. So imagine if you're the patient who's sort of strapped down to the floor of the space station. An astronaut would actually put their feet on the ceiling and stretch out their hands above their head and do chest compressions with them upside down.
Wow. So I know they receive training, but I think even if you've had training and you find yourself suddenly in the position of having to perform a surgery, that is probably a very daunting undertaking. So would they have support, maybe somebody like you on the phone walking them through the surgery?
I think that yes, you would try and have a form of teleremote support. The problem with that is that on a Mars mission, a one-way communication could take anywhere from 4 to 8 minutes. And in that time period, a patient could easily bleed to death. So I think it's going to be a combination of two things. One is yes, we'll always have a human surgeon for you to speak with. And the second component maybe a artificial intelligence telemedicine platform that would support the crew administering the surgical or medical care that's required. You have to remember that IBM Watson exists, and Watson did a phenomenal job in beating the pants off of Jeopardy contestants. So it's possible a Watson-like technology may be able to provide some surgical guidance.
What are some issues that astronauts might encounter, some health issues that somehow become more likely because you're in space?
There are a number of different body systems that are impacted by the spaceflight environment. The first organ that's impacted is your heart. We actually know that your heart shrinks and also has a reduced ability to completely fill with blood in space. And that can impact your ability to withstand surgery. your ability to exercise, or your body's ability to control your body's temperature. As well, we know that the spaceflight environment reduces your bone and muscle mass, and that puts you at higher risk for fall-related injuries and fractures, which may lead to the need for orthopedic surgery.
Let's say the specially trained astronauts have to perform a simple surgery in space. What are some of the big challenges there?
So one of the big challenges is that the space flight environment is not as clean as we would like it to be. There's been research to show that the bacterial count on board the space station is about 10 times higher than would be acceptable for an operating room here on Earth. So an astronaut undergoing surgery in space is at a much higher risk for a surgical infection because we can't keep the environment as clean as we would like. As well, you also have to remember that there are no showers on board the International Space Station. So
there are no showers?
No, there's currently no showers on board the space station right now.
So how do you clean up?
You would wipe yourself down with like a diaper wipe.
Are astronauts really, really smelly when they come back?
You'll have to ask them. I actually cannot answer that question for you. The only way to know, I guess, is to be in Russia when they land from the Soyuz and be right there.
If everybody gives them the Hollywood hug, then we know.
Remember, they're very brave and courageous people, and they really, really contribute a lot to our knowledge of both medicine and space, as well as here on Earth.
That's Julie Lin Wang. She's an aerospace medicine physician. And yes, 100% agreed. Astronauts are doing amazing work for the good of humanity. But I'm sure even astronauts, as wonderful as they are, get testy sometimes. In space, your colleagues become your roommates. You're living and working on top of each other. And your bosses back on Earth are issuing commands from mission control. Max Green takes us to a time when tensions boiled over.
It's 1973.
T-minus 9, 8, 7.
Three astronauts six, are about to rocket five, to nearly 300 four, miles above three, the surface of the Earth.
We have a liftoff.
The Skylab 4 astronauts had trained for several years, but mission captain Jerry Carr says the trouble started right then on takeoff.
A lot of guys had described that ride as like riding on a train with square wheels.
Jerry's 84 now and lives in Vermont. He says sure, they were expecting a bumpy ride, but it was so bad that Bill Pogue, an experienced demonstration pilot whose nickname ironically was Iron Belly, threw up.
We looked at him and said, good Lord, this guy is a former Thunderbird. He could do acrobatics in an airplane that would make the rest of us sick.
At the time, folks at Johnson Space Center in Houston were all uptight about a new thing called
Space Motion Sickness, or SMS. Space Motion Sickness has been called the most clinically significant medical phenomenon during the first 4 days of spaceflight.
So we decided that we would just not tell anybody about it.
The crew wanted to downplay the problem because they were worried doctors on the ground would overreact and it would become a whole thing. So they decided they'd conceal the evidence, maybe even throw the sick bag out of an airlock.
And that was a dumb thing to do because we had left our intercom system running.
The jig was up. Mission control was hip to their plan.
So it put us on the defensive right off the bat.
They got on a conference call, and the big boss in Houston gave them an earful. But things cooled off soon after, and they settled in for their 84-day stay aboard Skylab.
A working laboratory. Man's first home in space.
The equivalent of a small bungalow out there with a beautiful view of Earth.
Life was mostly normal, except, you know, in space. There was the daily routine of scientific experiments, cleaning, making repairs. There was a lot to do, and the crew quickly fell behind. The rigorous schedule was jam-packed from 6 in the morning until about 10 at night.
And that made a pretty long working day out of it.
Eventually, they were so far behind schedule, they were giving up days off to make up for it.
We lasted on that for about 40 days or so. Then we just, we pretty much had it.
Now, what happens next depends on who you ask. Jerry, the mission captain, says the crew wasn't paying attention and missed a chance to check in with mission control during a flyover. But other takes on the situation suggest the astronauts took an intentional break, kind of like giving themselves a timeout from the stress and what felt like micromanagement.
What has been called by some people as the mutiny.
Either way, there was some unexpected silence for a while. Then both sides acknowledged there was a problem, and about halfway through the mission, they all convened to share their feelings.
That's when we had our, what I call a sensitivity session in space.
They went back and forth. The Skylab program cost millions of dollars per day, and the whole world was watching. Houston didn't understand why deadlines were being missed and why the astronauts were griping about schedules. Up in space, Jerry and the others felt like they were being held to an almost impossible standard. They had no time to do basic things.
We had an antagonistic attitude there for some time, and before we got it off our chest, they got it off their chest, and then we went ahead and looked for a way to solve the problems.
So they negotiated and compromised. Mission Control would be more affirming about telling the guys up there when they did a good job. The crew would have more time to work out and take showers, something they almost never got to do, and they'd plan for one uninterrupted hour to unwind before bed each night. Both sides admitted some fault. Jerry says back then, talking about your feelings in space was just kind of a new thing.
We had none of that kind of training and no exposure whatsoever to it. So we were just playing it by ear. Sometimes we didn't do too well with it either.
In the end, the Skylab 4 crew got their day off. Jerry says he spent some of that time listening to music while enjoying the view of Earth. And what music were you listening to?
There's one funny song that says, when you're hot, when you're not, you're not. It was a popular young Western-style artist, Jerry Reed.
The Skylab 4 mission alerted NASA to a kind of problem it hadn't really run into before. Astronauts living in space full-time is very different from short missions in orbit. To try to get a better picture of what it's like to be up there on the space station for months on end, NASA had astronauts keep a journal. Here are some of those diary entries.
If each activity runs 5 minutes over, you can be 30 to 60 minutes in the hole before lunch.
We are constantly aware that the ground is watching and evaluating.
No one wants to be seen as a slacker or incapable, or as a complainer.
They gave me 10 minutes to work a procedure that required me to find a specific calibration bag. That alone consumed the 10 minutes.
Wish I had more to say, but after 52 days in space, life is 100% routine. If I went home tomorrow, I wouldn't be bummed.
Not much to write in the journal, since the days are the same as they have been for the last 4 months.
With the long work days, I've lost track of time. I have trouble recalling if I called my wife today or yesterday.
Sunday is meant to be a day of rest, but somehow Houston managed to make it feel like Monday.
Those were real journal entries from astronauts on board the International Space Station in the 2000s, with help from voice actors. And NASA has used those insights to try to prevent communication breakdowns. So I called the man whose job it is to better understand astronauts' thoughts and feelings.
Al Holland.
He's a NASA senior psychologist at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Al says accounting for our basic nature is key for successful missions beyond Earth orbit.
Clearly, we are humans wherever we are, whether we go out into space or we're on Mars or on the moon or we're next door.
And because the next place we want to go,
Mars,
is so far away, human training and prep is more important than ever.
It's going to be a radically different way of doing business.
It'll be the longest duration space flight we've done so far, more than a year to get there and back, plus time spent on the surface. And once you're there, you're tens of millions of miles from Earth. Messages will take about 20 minutes round trip. Al calls this communications delay comm lag.
That's going to lead, I think, to not only more pressure on the crew to be independent and to work independently, but there's going to be no opportunity for, you know, just natural conversation or for real-time video conferencing with your family.
And that comm lag will be the first time in the history of space travel that astronauts and home can't be in touch instantly, which can lead to disconnectedness with family and tension and conflict on the job, kind of like what happened in 1973.
There'll be a lot more strain on the understanding between the different camps. Because, you know, when you have less information, you have more room for speculation and misinterpretation, and that is a risk of a we-they dynamic beginning to increase.
Experts are working on some high-tech solutions to reduce comm lag using radios and lasers, but the reality of that delay isn't going away. So Al says NASA's focusing on training, preparing future space travelers for long-duration stays in isolation, problem-solving, and keeping cool. He says members of the first group to go to Mars may already be among a pool of selected astronauts. On top of planning for their first steps on the red planet, they'll also be working on their people skills. For The Pulse, I'm Max Green.
Oh,
Over the last couple of weeks, we asked you to send us questions about space, and we got one that's related to tensions, not between ground control and the crew, but rather tensions among the crew members.
I'm Nick Giovannucci. My question, living in close quarters, I can't imagine how astronauts always get along. So how do they resolve their differences?
So we figured this would be a great question for Al Holland, the expert we just heard from in Max's story. He said that astronauts get training to adapt to their team and to living in a confined area. The length of the mission can also impact what kind of astronaut NASA chooses.
We aren't looking for perfect people. In fact, if you've ever worked with someone who thinks they are perfect, you know that it's not a pleasant experience.
Instead, they look for people who are good at regulating their emotions and mending fences. For more on astronauts keeping the peace in space, check out the article by Liz Tung on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up, 3, 2, 1. Bake Off, bringing a taste of home to space. Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY. Cancer pushes us. We push back. Cancer Treatment Centers of America is challenging conventional thinking and is working to find smarter solutions. With 5 treatment centers located throughout the United States, CTCA is forging ahead with technology that wasn't available to cancer patients just a short time ago. More at cancercenter.com/outsmart.
Astronauts often become lab rats of sorts. Scientists have an intense interest in studying how space affects their health. So a chance to study identical twins who are also astronauts is sort of like winning the research lottery. When Scott Kelly was assigned to a year-long mission aboard the International Space Station, scientists chomped at the bit to study him compared to his brother, who was staying on Earth.
Mark Kelly. I guess I'm a former astronaut and a retired Navy captain.
Mark Kelly did 4 space missions, so his name is familiar, but he's also married to Gabrielle Giffords, the former Arizona congresswoman who was shot in 2011. Mark told me that 12 universities are involved in the twin study, doing 10 different research projects.
One of them, for example, had to do with the length of our telomeres, which is a structure on our DNA, and the length of your telomeres is indicative of how old you are. And the theory is that Scott's telomeres would shorten while he was in space because of the stress and zero gravity and just the basic stress of living there for a long period of time. Very interestingly, they did not get shorter. They actually got longer. And NASA's will now try to figure out why. But there were other things that looked at bone density, certain hormones in space that, you know, our body releases when it's under stress. There is also research of our microbiomes, which is the bacteria in our gut.
Let me ask you about the microbiome. What did they find about the bacteria in your gut as opposed to your brother in space's gut?
So, first of all, our microbiomes are different. In space, his changed. One bacteria took over and became the predominant bacteria in his microbiome, where it's not that case for him on Earth. And after he landed, it went back to normal. So there was something about being in space, about being in zero gravity, or maybe the radiation environment in space, that allowed one bacteria to take over the other. And where mine, you know, as I'm kind of like the control subject on the ground, mine pretty much stayed the same the whole time he was in space, as you would probably expect.
How did you feel about being the guy on the ground?
To go into space for a year is a big commitment. Scott had already done a long duration flight of up to 6 months. My longest flight into space was 16 days. And when you consider, you know, changes in my life with what happened to Gabby in January of 2011, at that point I realized my flight on STS-134 in the first part of 2011 was going to be my last mission. So, you know, I didn't feel like, oh, I really wish I was him going into space for a year. You know, a year is a really long time.
Were you two able to communicate fairly often?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that when we are in space, either of us in space, we actually tend to talk more than when we're on Earth, especially when he's in space for a year. You know, he would generally call me about once a day, where when we're both on Earth, we probably talk to each other about every other day or maybe every third day. But in space, it's almost every single day.
How come?
Well, I think when you're living on a space station, you're just disconnected from the planet. And, you know, I'm one of the people that's closest to him here on Earth. And the space station has a phone. You can make outbound phone calls. You can't call up. So if I want to talk to him in space, if I want to initiate the call, I've got to send him an email and say, call me.
So is your brother technically younger than you now?
Well, he was always younger than me. He was 6 minutes younger. I'm 6 minutes older. He got even further younger because of something called general relativity. You know, this started out as a theory that Albert Einstein had, that the faster you traveled, the slower time traveled. We later proved it by putting an atomic clock into space traveling at 17,500 miles an hour. So we now know that speed and time are related. And somebody did the math, and because my brother has traveled at 17,500 miles an hour for a little less than 500 days more than I have traveled at 17,500 miles an hour, time slowed down for him. So where I used to be 6 minutes older, now I am 6 minutes and 13 milliseconds older.
Ooh. So
not a lot.
Not a lot, but still something to lord over him, right?
Right. He got 13 milliseconds younger by spending 520 days in space.
Mark Kelly is a retired astronaut who is now consulting for private space companies. And there was something else I really wanted to ask him about. The food in space. Is it terrible? Is it like airplane food? Did he miss anything?
I'm happy with whatever NASA gives us to eat when we're in space. But my missions were all a couple weeks, you know, and you could stand on your head for a couple weeks if you had to, right? So when somebody has to go into space for 6 months, or in my brother's case, a year, those things become a lot more important.
I'm sure if you're in space for a long time, you start craving all kinds of foods. Paige Flager reports on a quest to bring a staple of our daily diet into the stratosphere.
Crumbs may seem harmless here on Earth, but they are the ultimate enemy in microgravity. They could get in the eyes of astronauts or be inhaled, making the astronaut choke. They could even get in electrical panels and burn up or cause a fire. That's part of the reason why it was a very, very big deal in 1965 when astronaut John Young pulled something out of his pocket as he was orbiting the Earth with Gus Grissom. Here are some voice actors reading from the flight transcript.
What is it?
It's a corned beef sandwich.
Where did that come from?
I brought it with me. Let's see how it tastes. Smells, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's breaking up.
Is it?
I'm gonna stick it in my pocket.
It was a thought, anyways.
Yeah.
Not a very good one.
Pretty good, though, if it would just hold together.
John Young smuggled the first corned beef sandwich into space. He took a bite, and then microgravity took over, spreading breadcrumbs throughout the spacecraft. Now, instead of bread, astronauts usually eat tortillas. But in the town of Bremen, in North Germany, tortillas don't cut it. You see, German astronaut Alexander Gerst is going to the International Space Station in 2018, and that got a man named Sebastian Marcoux and his friends thinking.
Look, Alexander Gerst, the German astronaut, is going up there. Shouldn't we do something to enable him to have fresh bread in space?
So Sebastian and his friends started a company called Bake in Space in March 2017.
Bread is a big topic here in Germany because we have 3,200 variations of bread.
They're partnered with the German Aerospace Center, which is basically Germany's NASA. And their goal is to make an oven that can successfully bake dough on the International Space Station by 2018. And that's easier said than done. First, the oven they make needs to function on about a tenth of the power an oven here on Earth does. And it's pretty much impossible to preheat the oven because if it gets hot and then the door is opened, a giant hot air bubble could leave the oven and float into the spacecraft.
It could just sit there in midair. And an astronaut could basically burn himself if he flies through it.
Which is clearly not ideal. Then there's the problem of the dough.
At low heat, the bread will have to bake for a longer period of time, but the longer it bakes, the drier it will get, and they have to avoid crumbling at all costs because of that whole crumbs in the eye or the esophagus thing. Despite all the technical challenges, Sebastian thinks they'll be able to have Alexander Gerst bake the first loaf of sourdough in space.
It's not just about making one German astronaut happy with fresh bread, but there's really a deeper meaning to bread in space.
Sebastian says that bread is ubiquitous. It's made its way onto our dinner tables, into our religion.
Lord, give us our daily bread.
Into our rap songs. Yeah, go is what I got, little mama. Go is what I got, Berlin. In the wise words of Lil Wayne, dough is what I've got. Breadwinner and dough stand for money, for well-being, for quality of life. We break bread with strangers as a gesture of good faith. Are you thinking, like, maybe if they encounter an alien, they can be like, hey, alien, here's this bread?
Well, it would definitely be a big symbol of peace to break bread with an alien life form, I think.
But most importantly to Sebastian, freshly baked bread in space will offer astronauts a little slice of home.
And that's Paige Flago reporting. And Paige, for this story, you solicited bread in space puns online. And even though that was a very specific request, people really came through.
Yeah, the internet was really up to it. So let's read some of these. In space, baking is the yeast of your worries.
Okay.
If you need help, just holla for Houston.
Okay, I like that one.
That's a good one.
For the love of science, for the loaf of bread.
That's one small step for Bran. Get it?
Yes.
Like one small step for man. Okay.
Well done.
Thank you, internet.
Thank you. Space travel used to be the domain of highly trained astronauts. They are there to do a job, but that is starting to change. Visitors have already made trips into orbit and to the International Space Station, and SpaceX is planning to launch two tourists on a trip around the moon. That's prompted a group of science educators to create an interactive theater experience where real astronomers help you plan a trip to space. Two of the travel guides wrote a book called Vacation Guide to the Solar System. All right, buckle up.
Hello, welcome to the Intergalactic Travel Bureau. I'm Jana Gersovich. I'll be your travel agent today.
And I'm Olivia Koski. We are professional space vacation planners, and we're very excited to tell you about some top destinations in the solar system that you have to visit before you die.
Or perhaps as you die. Mercury is great for people who like contrast and who also might have a little bit of a death wish.
The radiation is incredibly high on Mercury. It's the closest planet to the sun. Because Mercury is so close to the sun, it orbits a lot faster than the Earth does. So its year is only several months long. But the day lasts many months. And because the planet rotates so slowly, you can actually walk the terminator line on Mercury, which is the line that divides night and day. So you can actually walk with the sunset. On the dark side, you probably could not survive on the surface of Mercury.
But I think, you know, the idea of being able to walk along with that line, experiencing this eternal sunset, whether or not there are humans there to experience it, it's actually happening on Mercury.
One of our favorite things to do is to visit Saturn's moon Titan. Titan is great for adventurers who enjoy boating in its methane seas or who might want to try flying in its atmosphere. Titan has a very thick atmosphere and low gravity, and under these conditions, it's actually quite easy to fly under your own power with the help of a flight suit.
While you're near Saturn, of course, you want to see the rings, which are these particles of ice. Some of them are tiny, some of them are as big as a building. And so you can float around, orbit around Saturn as one of the little moonlets, as a part of the rings of Saturn. And also, Saturn has moons that are orbiting within the gaps in the rings. The Cassini gap is the most famous one of those. And so you could imagine landing on one of those moons and orbiting around Saturn. So you might want to visit Jupiter. Jupiter, of course, is this giant gas planet with beautiful swirling cloudscapes. It's great for artists, and it's also great for skydivers. So if you were to go skydiving on Jupiter, you'd be falling through these swirling clouds. It would become dark, so you'd be falling in darkness in this very alien environment as it slowly would get hotter and denser, and eventually you'd just implode.
Jupiter is also good for experimental musicians.
Yeah, so Jupiter has this really strong magnetic field. And so what that does is it can be picked up on radio. And if you had a radio tuned in and you were in the vicinity of Jupiter, you would hear kind of eerie sounds.
So in addition to these trippy space sounds, Jupiter has incredible moons. There's this moon called Io, which is covered in volcanoes. And then it has a moon called Europa nearby. It has this many miles thick layer of ice covering what they think is a liquid water ocean. And Europa is the place that scientists believe in the solar system outside of Earth that there might actually be the possibility for microbial life. So you could be the first to discover life outside of Earth on Jupiter's moon Europa.
Yeah, provided you could stay alive in the first place, but...
That was science writer Olivia Kosky and astronomer Jana Gersovich. They are the authors of Vacation Guide to the Solar System. Liz Tung produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Alan Yu. This week, we have to say goodbye to Elizabeth Fiedler. She's leaving radio to pursue a whole new mission. Part of that mission will be to take care of two small Earthlings. We'll miss you, Liz. We had help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. Liz Tung is our Pulse intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager is our associate producer, and she dug around in the deepest corners of the NASA archives and found this moment from the Apollo 16 mission. Astronaut John Young was on the moon, and he had a very human problem inside of his spacesuit. We had a voice actor read this from the transcripts.
I have the farts again. I got them again, Charlie. I haven't eaten this much citrus fruit in 20 years, and I'll tell you one thing. Another 12 10 days, I ain't never eaten any more. Oh.
Orion, Houston?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Daniel, we have a hot mic.
How long have we had that?
And us terrestrial radio people can certainly relate to the problem of the hot mic. Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Tanya English is our managing editor. Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Neurosciences. At Penn Neurosciences, brain and spine specialists work together to help people break through the darkness of their disease. From delivering clinical research to finding new approaches to treat MS and epilepsy to developing advanced procedures for brain and spine disorders, the Penn Neurosciences team cares for each patient and their individual needs. More information is available at pennmedicine.org/neuro.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.